Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I almost have a voice again, so that's, you know, nice to be back a little bit. And
I miss Macy Gray, Erin. Macy Gray, Erin, was just like really intense and kind of sultry.
She is very intense. I prefer Kathleen Turner, Erin, but that's a very rare and sort of like very minor point in the cold progression. We have with us today Lindsay Kahn. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Also with a bit of a cold, so we're all just, you know, having as much honey and whiskey, actually, as I think we can. Lauren, what are we drinking?
You brought it. It appears to be some barrel-aged Manhattans for which I offered to marry you. I am already married, so that may be illegal in the place that we are currently residing. But were the chance open to me from High West Distillery?
The High West Distillery barrel-aged Manhattans.
This was on our holiday list last year, for which I will tell you all, we're already discussing our holiday list for the upcoming holiday season. So, you know, look forward to that. But this one was a delightful addition to my life last year, and I think everyone should purchase it.
They're so classy, but it's just booze in a bottle. It's great. Radha, are you drinking anything fun?
I am. I'm drinking a mimosa, and I'm showing everyone that I'm drinking it out of a glass that has my name etched on it because I live with some friends upstairs who we share a nanny with, and we got team wine glasses with our names on them so we could keep track of our continual alcohol consumption while caring for our small children.
Did you also get a tiara?
Not yet, but we're working on it. Look, we've been locked inside for weeks. We're a little bored here. The air is not good, and so clearly mixing things with champagne in personalized glasses is the answer.
As a reminder for listeners, Radha lives in the hellscape that is California right now and probably hasn't seen the sky in weeks at this point in time.
I'm not. It's like I feel like I should have more like post-apocalyptic clothing or something, like maybe like rags with some leather patches.
I definitely do not have a post-apocalyptic wardrobe.
No.
We could work on it, though. Maybe we could add that to our holiday list.
Right.
Shall we start, Lindsay, with the bombshell questions?
Okay, we should remind everyone. Professor Dr. Lindsay Kahn is an associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College and brings to us an extensive background and expertise in civil military relations and many other exciting and fun things that are reasons that we love her. So we'll start out with the bombshell questions. The first one is, what is your entrance music?
You know, I had to think about this one a lot, and I suppose it depends on what I'm entering. Like, I would pick different music if I were going into a UFC fight than if I were entering, I don't know, the Colbert Show. But I think my...
I like that those are your options.
Me too.
Yeah, good options. Those are my two options. I think I settled on a famous Pugliese tango called La Yumba, which is phenomenal and dramatic.
It's by far the most sophisticated answer anybody's ever given us.
That was amazing.
Oh, really?
Pronunciation and all, really.
My other option was Pain Lies on the Riverside by Live, if any of you remember that group.
I actually love the mental image of either of those at a UFC fight or the Colbert Show. So you're already batting a thousand here. next question, this is one of my favorites, is what is a book that you hate but everyone else loves?
Probably The Great Gatsby. I've always hated that book, and it's one of those books that everyone seems to really like. I'm not sure, though, that anyone actually likes that book. They just all have to read it in high school. So I would say anything John Steinbeck, which some people really do like.
I'm with you on that. I do, in fact, like The Gatsby, but Steinbeck does absolutely nothing for me.
Speaking of, you know, alcoholism ruining your life, what is your favorite bar in the world?
So this was my favorite one of your questions because the answer was immediate and easy. It's called Kieran Danny Mike's. It's a bar it's on a small island off the southwestern tip of County Cork in Ireland. And when I used to live in Cork, I used to be really involved in the traditional music scene there. And one weekend, a bunch of us musicians just decided to pack our instruments and basically no extra clothing and go down to Clear Island for a few days. And that's the pub that we stayed at. And we just played music and ate and wandered over the island and slept for about 4 days straight. It was fabulous.
Have you ever been back?
Not to that pub, no.
Just lives in the memory.
Yeah.
It's
I'll
perfect.
Never forget it.
What is your most quoted movie line?
What is your favorite color? No, that's not it. but it's from the same film. It's either, now we see the violence inherent in the system, or it's only a model. And those are the two. They come up when I'm teaching all the time, so I say them a lot. Both from Monty Python and the Holy Grail for any Philistines in the audience.
So your students are at least, they're slightly older, because I would worry, I teach 20, like early 20-something students, and they would not know any of those, and it would make me very sad. Do your students recognize those lines?
No, they do not.
even worse. I fear for our Navy.
Lauren and I were talking to high school students last week, and I realized I had no meaningful pop culture references that I could share with them of any kind
whatsoever.
We brought
up The X-Files and West Wing, and it was just like stone cold.
I tried referring to 24 at one point, and they were all like, what?
This is why having a dorky husband is helpful, because I recently gave a talk to a bunch of 20-something engineers and used The Flash as a reference for counterfactuals. True story, I had to do it, and they all laughed, and I was very popular.
All right, Radha, it's your showtime.
I assume that when you said that the bar question was your favorite, it's because you'd forgotten about this one, which is, what is the best use of data and or statistics you've ever seen?
Oh, well, so this one, I apologize, I have to do a self-plug because it was so sort of revelatory. When I did my dissertation, I had this theory. And I went off bouncing off to Europe to collect data for it, and discovered that Europeans don't collect data. And
true fact.
So it was really, that's not true. Of course they do, but they have a lot more limitations on it than we do. And so there was no data. So I ended up having to do a 100% qualitative dissertation, which was lovely, but not terribly conclusive. And so later, I ran into the lovely Dr. Nathan Toronto, who had collected an original data set and was wandering about looking for a good use to put it to. And I met him at a conference and said, and, you know, basically data love ensued. And we wrote a paper together in which we used his gigantic data set to demonstrate that my theory was supported, that there is a significant relationship between labor market structure and the long-term use of conscription.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was thrilled.
Rana, that's a labor economist argument.
I mean, everything about this answer is delightful, and I just feel like, when in doubt, collect a novel data set, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
Okay, moving on. We want to talk about civil-military relations, and we have, well, lots to talk about.
We do.
Yes, we do.
And we have a nice sort of initial, I guess I would say, object lesson of sorts on the U.S.-Mexico border, where Secretary Mattis and Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen made a recent visit to go inspect the nearly 6,000 U.S. military troops that are deployed there in order to stop a caravan of people coming up through Mexico, who are not actually invading the country, but here to seek some sort of refugee status of some kind. So this brings up all kinds of fascinating questions to us in terms of civil military relations. But before we get started on those, I just wanted to get a sense from Lindsay, what exactly is going on the border? What are we attempting to do from the U.S. Department of Defense? What are we attempting to do on the border here?
Well, that depends on whom you ask, but in sort of objective terms, as you mentioned, we have nearly 6,000 troops there about now. Just the other day, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Shanahan, said that he thought that this was probably a peak. Defense Secretary Mattis has said it might go as high as 7,000. They've all made clear that if the DOD receives further requests from DHS, they would be ready to support, but that no such requests have been made. So this may be as many as we're going to see, maybe not. But the number of 10 to 15,000 floated by Mr. Trump at a point earlier is very unlikely. So we bought a little less than 6,000 right now, and it's mostly it's almost entirely Army and Marines, largely engineers, logisticians, and military police. And their mission, according to multiple officials, is to support Customs and Border Protection and Border Patrol. And some examples of what they're doing are, as has been in the news, reinforcing border barriers. That's the concertina wire and crossing points. So, for example, the 7th Engineering Support Battalion Marines from Camp Pendleton is there. MPs from the 93rd MP Battalion at Fort Bliss, that's Army, are there doing. And the MPs are doing force protection. So for all of the troops who are hanging out at the border putting up concertina wire, they need guards. And so that's what the MPs are doing. And according to reports right now, only the MPs are armed. I don't know if that's true. That's just what's being reported. I don't have any inside information on that. So right now, there are about 1,300 in California, about 2,800 in Texas, about 1,500 in Arizona. So far, no active duty troops in New Mexico because the terrain is quite rough there and nobody expects anybody to try to come across. And the thing that no one's quite sure about yet, of course, aside from the actual mission, is how much all of this is going to cost.
And I think, you know, it's interesting to, like, I think your breakdown is right, like into mission and cost, and the mission piece gets extra confusing when you start thinking about the authorities under which these troops could or should operate. They obviously can't do law enforcement duties because of posse comitatus, and that means that includes some of their surveillance activities, right? So they can surveil general areas, but they like can't surveil crowds. They can't, like, so a range of their, like, surveillance and enforcement activities are curtailed. So do you have a sense or sort of any insights into how the very strange rules of engagements and activities here would be sort of, like, overseen and communicated to troops and, like, what those, how to think about that in the context of deploying active duty forces inside the United States borders?
They can do a lot of things. They can design their information collection to benefit law enforcement organizations. The restrictions on them in terms of what they cannot do are really basically they can't engage in seizures of contraband, for example. They cannot arrest anyone. They cannot be involved in searches of any person or vehicle, things like that, unless they were specifically authorized by law or deemed necessary under special circumstances, neither one of which I'm aware of being done right now. As far as ROE, which is something that was in the news quite a bit, I don't know what their ROE are, but the it's been stated several times by both DOD and DHS officials that the plan is for troops not to come in contact with migrants at all, except incidentally. You know, if they happen to be with a Border Patrol unit when they come across migrants, and then they're not supposed to engage with them. So this is not, this is different, at least from what we've heard in the reporting. This is different from some of the Border Patrol missions that U.S. troops did in the 1990s, where they were literally patrolling the border themselves and sometimes engaged in exchanges of fire. So my assumption is that the ROE would be very restrictive. As I mentioned, as far as I understand, the only troops that are armed are the MPs.
So, Lindsay, one of the reasons we wanted to bring you on to give us some context on this is you have in the past provided some really good context to how this relates to domestic uses of U.S. military personnel in the past, by which I want to specify, you know, there's a lot of reactions, particularly in the Twitter sphere, whenever something like this comes up of like, oh, this is not what U.S. military is for. This is not what we do. We do not stand for this. And you have pointed out multiple times that actually we have many times in the past done not only things exactly like this, but things that like might be perceived as more extreme uses of U.S. military personnel for domestic purposes. So if you could provide a little more context on that, not that it will necessarily be reassuring to anybody, but it may be maybe more context providing than we are currently, our current kind of principled views may give us right now.
Sure. And I'll try and be succinct, although I went ahead and made a non-exhaustive list of post-posse comitatus uses of the military on domestic soil and ended up just quitting at some point because there were so many of them. But so let me go. So from the beginning, so from the Constitution up until the Civil War, law enforcement was actually the main thing that the army did. Obviously, as you know, we had a very small standing army, and mostly it was stationed in the West on the frontiers. And its main jobs were law enforcement. It generally was trying to protect federal property against various frontiersmen and pioneers, but also against states, because the states and the federal government frequently had a lot of beefs with each other. The army was also responsible for Indian affairs for most of that time, which was both positive and negative. Obviously, the army and the Indians did not have a great relationship with each other, and there were lots of abuses of power. But the army also intervened in multiple cases to protect Indians against both pioneers and state forces. So for that, the first 100 years or so, that's almost all the army did. Then you had, after the Civil War, you had the Reconstruction period. And especially during the Grant presidency, so before Posse Comitatus, but after the Civil War, you had a couple of situations there where not only President Grant sent federal troops to try to protect the rights of black freedmen in southern states, but Congress passed the Reconstruction Acts, which actually established martial law in multiple southern states and sent military governors to those states. After Posse Comitatus, you see a lot of labor intervention, lots and lots of labor intervention. So throughout the 1890s and early 1900s, you just had one after another of these strikes being broken up, or not just strikes. So one of the more famous ones is the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921, where a bunch of coal miners had been kicked out of their homes. They wanted to unionize. The mine owners resisted. Battle ensued. President Harding ordered federal troops in, and he threatened to send in bombers. He threatened to use U.S. bombers against miners.
Bombers in 1921?
Yeah.
Speaking the same thing. That's
amazing.
Drop
it off the side.
So private planes were hired, these private security services, private planes were hired and did in fact drop gas and explosives on the miners. U.S. forces didn't release ordnance, but they were standing ready. I mean, this was a real thing. So things like that happened a lot. And then a lot of people know about like the Bonus Army being cleared from Washington, D.C., right, by President Hoover. From the sort of 1880s through World War II, approximately, it was mostly anti-labor use. And then you start having race riots, and then you start having use basically to put down riots. And then, of course, in the late 1980s, President Reagan declared sort of war on drugs type stuff. And that's when you started having a lot of use of the U.S. military along the southern border to try and enforce counter-narcotics efforts. That's where we got the so-called militarization of the border. So I'll stop there, but I really could go on and on and on.
So what do we take from that in terms of both kind of the appropriateness? It's a very odd feature of American democracy, right? That we don't use active duty troops for domestic deployment. That is an Anglo-American sort of orientation. Though, of course, regular troops in Great Britain were deployed in Northern Ireland for a very long time. Many normal democratic countries deploy troops domestically, deploy troops at the border. It is, in fact, a quite inherent responsibility of armed forces to police the border and to engage in, if not law enforcement activity, then military activities at the border. Do we have kind of a broader sense of how we should understand the current state of civil-military relations or domestic use of the military based on this activity?
I mean, this kind of use of the military does differ pretty substantially across different countries. There are lots of countries, as you say, for whom it's fairly normal. Certainly, there are lots of countries for whom border protection is quite normal. There are lots of other countries that have specific rules saying that the military can't be used for domestic law enforcement, but they frequently have a special paramilitary police force, like the Gendarmerie or the Carabinieri.
Carabinieri, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So those countries, in countries where there is a specific legal statutory reason why the military can't be used that way, they tend to have a sort of police force that's specialized to do those kinds of things. We don't have that, obviously. In terms of a larger sort of implication for civil-military relations, the one that I think is fascinating, and I haven't figured this out entirely yet, is what it says about us that this myth that the U.S. military cannot be used domestically or for any kind of domestic purposes and never has been so used, where does that come from, and why are people so convinced not only that it's true, but that it is central to our survival as a democracy? I don't know where it comes from, and I think it's fascinating culturally. Like, what is it about the idea that soldiers shouldn't be used at home that Americans need so badly? I'm not sure.
I thought about this a lot recently too, and I'm not bringing a scholar's perspective to this, but it feels to me as a post-Vietnam, post-professionalized military version of, politics stops at the water's edge, that, you know, the military is not for political purposes, and thus we will not utilize it for such, which lines up historically a little, but not terribly well, particularly when we start telling ourselves that national security is not itself a political issue, that it's more of a technocratic and analytic issue. So I have personally raised this question for myself, but also kind of feel as though it's something that we national security professionals have kind of taught ourselves. It's not just the American people, is that national security professionals feel almost this like holy priesthood like feeling about that we shall not use the military for these purposes. But actually we have a lot in the past.
And I think there's a little piece here, and that's probably worth us talking about in future episodes, which is we tend to divide military and national security issues from domestic law enforcement issues in a very stark and not wholly defensible line.
And in particular, immigration is not a national security issue.
Correct. And so we tend to then think of law enforcement as being reserved for states with very particular things carved out to the federal government. And that actually is a long and important sort of federalist roots in it. And so it's worth kind of keeping in mind that this law enforcement distinction, which is kind of the crux of why the military isn't used domestic, I think derives not just from the post-Vietnam, but from some core notions on what like federal versus state powers are. And that goes back a long way and is a whole separate discussion. But there is a sort of separate issue there from the more traditional civ-mil concerns. And so probably something we'll be talking about again and again as immigration continues to be a national security and a domestic security issue.
Yeah, I mean, can I respond to two of those points?
Please do.
Yeah, so one, Aaron, you jumped in and said, and we tend not to think of immigration as a national security issue, and I'm sure we'll come back to this if we have time, but of course that's exactly what the president has tried to make this particular deployment about, and that's sort of the civ-mil issue that I think we have with that. But to get back to Lauren's point about, and what Radha said as well about this being a sort of maybe a more recent phenomenon, I'm not entirely sure. You know, a lot of people also tend to think of the all-volunteer force as a really new thing. But of course, for most of our history, we had only an all-volunteer mm-hmm. force. And I can guarantee you that the vast majority of those uses, those domestic uses of troops that I mentioned, they were all done by regulars. Those were not draftees. We only had conscripts during actual wars up until after World War II. And we didn't use any of them in domestic disturbances during the time that we had them. So it's really interesting, I think, to keep in mind that all of those uses of troops, those were regulars, those were professionals. They were not conscripts, they were not draftees, they were standing army personnel.
Well, this is a favorite topic of ours and one that we could talk about for as the day is long. But unfortunately, we have many other pressing topics to walk on to. So, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you can come back again here soon and regale us with tales of the vagaries of American civil-military relations throughout the years. Thanks again.
Anytime. Thanks.
So pressing on to keeping up foreign relations, I think the piece that we are most capturing our imagination this week is Brexit, mm-hmm. Which obviously we've talked about many times, but it really is the gift that keeps on giving. For better or worse, it is literally never ending. So, Radha, do you want to bring us up to speed on kind of what happened just this last week and what the state of play is today?
Sure. So, just as a reminder, the UK wants to leave the EU, so they've got a little breakup negotiation going, and it's like all divorces kind of contentious and continuous with a lot of unrealistic expectations on especially the British side. In particular, the sort of holdup is how they negotiate an agreement that covers everything from police cooperation and intel sharing to trade and movement of goods to movement of peoples. And of particular interest is what they do with the border with Northern Ireland. Just to sum up, the key trade-off is really in whether the UK can regulate the labor mobility, which is sort of the core issue of Brexit, but maintain free trade of goods, which is basically a non-starter for the EU. And the current compromise has the UK in the customs union, which would essentially mean that the UK would not be able to charge tariffs to goods that flow across the border from Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland, and so would be subject to the trade deals of the European Union, but without any input into those deals or agreements, which doesn't sound that awesome.
So for those of us who are not labor economists, right, this week, Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, presented a plan to her cabinet that tried to basically navigate all of these issues.
Yes.
And it is, how you say, nobody's first choice.
So My analogy, this is really simplistic, but this is really what is going on here, is that Theresa May presented basically I'm dating an asshole, but I want to be friends with benefits. I just really want to be friends with benefits. And the other cabinet ministers in the room were more in a Carrie Underwood before he cheats kind of mode of like Louisville slugger to his four-wheel drive, keying his car, setting his house on fire. And she was like, take it or leave it, assholes. Guys, you got to be, are you with me or are you not? And they initially...
Well, that's the question. Are they with her or are they not? So two of the key ministers resigned this week.
Which, what I love about that is they initially said, all the ministers are on board.
Except the Brexit minister. So now this plan, which is trying to artfully elide the issues that Radha dutifully notes for us, goes to Parliament. And this is one of these things from a foreign policy perspective where we're kind of like with American immigration, and of course, immigration in the UK is a key element of this whole Brexit situation. There's huge amounts of domestic politics playing into high-level foreign policy pieces. There's no distinction between the two. And so now you have Theresa May trying to navigate, one, getting agreement on the exact text of her Brexit deal. She needs approval. She has it from the cabinet-ish. Now she needs it from the parliament, which means the parliament, because of the way British parliamentary system is set up, is essentially could tee up a vote of no confidence, which would basically say they no longer want Theresa May to be the prime minister. In the UK, basically, if you're the prime minister and you introduce a bill or legislation and it doesn't pass, that's super bad because the reason you're the prime minister is because you have a majority. So it's very different from the American system. But there's sort of this question about whether the conservatives who are in favor of a hard Brexit, can in fact generate a vote of no confidence. This plays into some interesting dynamics with the Labour Party, currently led by Corbyn.
Jeremy Corbyn, everyone's favorite.
Literally no one's favorite. And, you know, how they're going to play this. I mean, sort of the crux of the question for the parliamentary debate is like, is this as good a deal as you could get conditional on leaving the European Union? Right.
I think we should honestly turn it over to Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn to have a dance-off. And like, how could it be worse than what we're doing right now?
So the third piece of this, so we have the text of the deal, the vote of no confidence, and now a number of other folks are sort of introducing this idea of a second referendum. And I was in the UK last week, and the only thing that people that I could agree, that I would talk to could agree on is that there's no appetite amongst normal people to have a second referendum and go to all of this again. Although it seems like a very artful solution from kind of the elite level. So this is just, you know, candlesticks are a great gift. We're dealing with a lot of shit here, you know, and this is still totally a mess. Like, even though there's now a sort of draft agreement between the EU and the United Kingdom, I feel like we're like no closer to actually figuring out what's going to go on with Brexit. And we could still have a hard Brexit or a crash out, as they've called it, you know, 6 months from now or 4 months from now.
I saw an amazing possible solution, which is basically to go with May's proposed deal, but force her to resign in some way. Like, all right, we'll go with your deal, but force you to resign because we just like freaking hate you.
Yeah, that would never happen to a man.
No.
That is 100% a thing that's only being talked about because she's a woman.
It is absolutely. Yes.
And we'll save this to fight another day, because there's no chance this is the last time we're going to talk about Brexit. And in future times, we will let Radha talk about her fascination with these customs unions.
They're so interesting, guys. You should. I'll include a couple links in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm not going to read those, just so you know. Okay, so in case we didn't think that the relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union was complicated enough, let's talk about our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Because why not?
It's peachy.
It's super peachy and super straightforward. Radha, why don't you start with the not so sexy parts of this, and we'll get up to the drama that happened in just the last 48 hours on the U.S. side.
Yeah, I mean, so the long story short, we sanctioned a bunch of people who were involved in the killing of journalist Khashoggi. We sanctioned them under this thing called the Magnitsky Act, which relates to human rights abuses. And it basically means those individuals designated can't use U.S. banking systems, and no one who uses U.S. banking systems can interact with those individuals. So it's it
sounds
pretty
like kind
tough
of a
sanctions.
Big deal.
It is a big deal. It's none of the sanctions are on the Saudi leadership, and in particular MBS, who everyone thinks was involved and the
we'll
Turks
get to
in
that.
Particular have noted. But you know, it indicates some willingness to respond to this and suggests that the US does believe that there were some relatively senior people involved. We've also sort of break. Separately, we've also stopped supporting the refueling of aircrafts for the Saudi-led air quotes coalition that's engaged in Yemen. So basically that means we've stopped supporting their ongoing missions. Now, supposedly this is something we did sort of in consultation with them, but hard to know if that's true or if finally we got fed up with the pretty good evidence of human rights abuses and sort of extreme actions by that campaign, or if we're just generally cross with the Saudis and don't want to refuel their planes anymore.
I love it when you talk about people being cross with each other. It's my favorite. But I mean, so at some level, right, various elements of the U.S. system are responding to this, you know, kind of breach of the relationship, right? The clear evidence that's been provided of the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi and what that should mean for basically business as usual is not going to occur. We still don't really have a good sense of what that means long term, but in the near term, we've got some sanctions against individuals under Magnitsky, and we've got some revisions to U.S. participation in this war on Yemen, at least at this sort of small-ish level, if not at the overall level. Lauren, what happened in the last 48 hours here in Washington that might further drive this story?
So it is rare that the intelligence community does a kind of coordinated FU to the White House to be able to say, we are leaking, and not only leaking to an individual paper, we are leaking to all the papers of record about our agreed high confidence in an intelligence finding. And I mentioned this to note that this is a big deal. This is basically telling the intelligence community, telling the White House, we do not trust you on a matter of foreign policy, and thus we are going public with it. And obviously, this did not occur on the record, but it did occur in a coordinated manner, in such that a lot of the people who follow the intelligence community are freaked out.
Tell us what happened.
Oh my God, the process is much more interesting than the substance. We already knew the substance. Which the substance is that it with high confidence an agreement that Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, was behind the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, which I think everybody knew. But the fact that the intelligence community is willing to come out and say that with high confidence and leak it to the Washington Post, New York Times, and many other outlets is astonishing, and we should not underwrite that.
I read the Washington Post article and then wanted to I needed eye bleach. There was so much SIGINT being released verbatim in that article.
It was really uncomfortable.
Pants. Sorry, that is signals intelligence. The way that article is written is basically we have transcripts of phone calls. Would you like to see them? And let's just say, if you have a clearance, that's really hard to read in the open press.
Right. Shane Harris, God bless you.
And
your
sources.
Friends.
Everybody listen to Rational Security this week, where obviously they're going to talk more about this. But
they basically just put the president in the corner and say, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
So Susan Hennessy had a point on this that I thought was pretty important, which was basically the intelligence community does not have good protocols or norms about what to do when the president lies about matters of intelligence. matters of national security are one thing, but matters of intelligence are another. And clearly the community felt compelled, or at least key persons within, I don't know, CIA, NSA, ODNI. I don't really know where exactly the leaks came from, but clearly they were, as you note, Lauren, were high level and coordinated to make sure everybody got the story.
And extraordinarily detailed. That was my takeaway. Yes. Like, I mean, you saw a little bit of this post George W. Bush and the intelligence and sort of information surrounding the motivations for the Iraq War, but just, I don't know that I don't know if I've really ever seen like this level of detail where reading the article, you could figure out where and who they were recording when. Like, that is just tremendous amount of sources and methods to be in multiple media sources simultaneously. It's like still shaking my head.
To close out one final point on this, it just as a reminder that Jamal Khashoggi was a U.S. permanent resident. Like, we're not talking about, you know, random stray foreigner. Yes, he was an employee of the Washington Post, but he was also a U.S. permanent resident, which I assume also factored into this, you know, highly coordinated, highly unprecedented, and just amazing coordinated leak that we saw that was a Mr. Trump, we are putting you in the corner.
But this is the second instance in the last 2 years where sources have revealed that we have bugged two U.S. ambassadors located here in Washington. One was Kislyak after the Flynn Kislyak conversations just after the elections in 2016. And now, I mean, part of the reporting on this story is not just about Mohammed bin Salman, but his brother Khalid, who is the ambassador to the United States. And apparently we have bugged. It is crazy pants that this is in the Washington Post. And I mean, it makes for great drama. I'm sure I would love it in a spy novel as a national security professional.
I know, but even talking about it makes my stomach hurt a
little
bit. Oh my
God. I mean, it's just a lot. And we apologize for maybe mischaracterizing this under Keeping Up Foreign Relations and not White House Mayhem, but we just need some like SIGINT is whack section that we, you know, collect these stories sort of in from now on.
And speaking of mayhem, Aaron, what is going on there?
Let's bring the temperature down. Let's bring the temperature down a little bit to talk about the National Defense Strategy Commission.
Before we get the National Security Defense Strategy, we got to talk about like some personnel nonsense.
Okay, fine. Keep the blood pressure up. Do it.
Can somebody explain to me how come the First Lady is issuing statements on deputy national security advisors?
Because she... It is the position of her office that the First Lady no longer, that this Mary Ricardo no longer deserves the honor of serving in the White House. It's an amazing statement.
Aaron, I think she was cross.
The First Lady was very cross. So, like, amidst the various dramas going on this week, to include fires in California and ongoing election recounts following the midterms, the Deputy National Security Advisor was, like, unceremoniously fired. I mean, she's basically defenestrated. Like, she's basically thrown out a window.
We don't really know why, but one of the reasons why that I love a lot is that there were arguments over who was going to get a seat on the First Lady's plane and where on the First Lady's plane when she went to Africa. And having been a special assistant to senior officials, that just like warms my heart a little bit that was why.
So Mira Ricardel, people may remember from such controversies as why Ann Patterson can't be the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, and who is this new Undersecretary of Defense for Commerce. She had been on the Defense Department transition team very early on in the administration and approved a lot of appointees to the Defense Department in the new Trump administration. She was very much part of the enforcement of the Never Trumper kind of ban. She then moved on to the Commerce Department and got brought back for the White House, as I read 7 months ago, which seems like a lifetime, when she was brought back by John Bolton to become the Deputy National Security Advisor when he took over from H.R. McMaster.
She is the third Deputy National Security Advisor.
You pointed out fifth.
Well, okay, yeah. To be fair, there are different kinds of Deputy National Security Advisor. She's the third Deputy National Security Advisor of all the national securities and not just the strategic planning part. But like, Third by itself. We haven't even hit 2 years yet.
We're really cranking through them. And apparently she racked up quite an enemies list, although I find most of the writing about her quite gendered in its own particular way. As far as I can tell, no one but John Bolton is going to miss her now that she's gone, not the least of which is John Kelly or Jim Mattis. But she was certainly running a particular process there while she was at the National Security Council.
So you don't think that that Mira and John Kelly are going to be going out for drinks in a couple weeks when John Kelly's out of the White House?
I do not. But you raise an interesting point, which is that she's not the only departure that has been. I mean, the leaks and counter leaks. Apparently, Mira Ricardo had been a great source for Josh Rogan over the years. But the leaks and counter leaks
subtweeting
over this departure were quite something. And that does bring us then to, you know, the part of the Defense Department, which has also been rumored to have quite a few departures coming up, which is OSD policy. And, you know, what do we think about what is going on at OSD? And as relates to that, the National Defense Strategy, of which we have a new assessment out.
Right. So a lot of our super wonky friends wrote an assessment of the National Defense Strategy recently and published it, which happens frequently. And it's, you know, the high points of it are typical of these such assessments, that basically that we need to spend a lot more, that we need to be doing more about Russia and China, and we need to be focusing more on high-end near-peer competition. However, there were some points in this assessment from our dear wonky friends that were pretty unique and quite focused on how Secretary Mattis is actually running the department itself. The fact that they focused on civil-military relations as a national security challenge right now is an emergency in some ways, as well as focused on the analytic capacity of the department to support what they called decision support. So from the Cost Analysis Program Evaluation Office, the Joint Staff Office, as well as the Policy Office, helping the Secretary of Defense have the analytic capacity to make decisions is vital in their view. But it was a civil military relations component that got a lot of attention in the press and was highlighted by many as a true crisis in a lot of ways that some of us, me, were focusing on in 2016 and are now kind of patting themselves on the back, maybe ever so slightly.
I'll pat you on the back for that as well. I mean, there was also Lara Seligman from Foreign Policy had a piece about the departures from OSD policy and kind of the tensions between that shop and the joint staff. And we've obviously talked a lot about this over the last couple of years. It's kind of a defining feature of the early Trump administration, given the challenges people had getting individuals in, maybe because of Mira Ricardo, but perhaps for other reasons. The joint staff is like having a day in the sun, right? I mean, it is a great day to be on the joint staff.
I hope they are getting all of the boondoggles that they can, because if they need to like get that done now.
But OSD policy is a freaking ghost town. And for folks who maybe don't always know the difference in the vagaries of these elements within the Pentagon, that the joint staff works for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. OSD policy reports directly to the secretary and really is the civilian element of this, and has a lot of the longstanding career civil servants, which, I mean, there are career civil servants in the joint staff as well, but the civilian oversight really comes out of OSD policy, and they are having a frickin' time of it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the OSD, in my view, and I think, you know, Lara's article in Foreign Policy did a lot of talking about this. There's a lot of value in having the sort of person in the room saying, that's not consistent with these authorities. Here's how we should do this. Here are concerns with this. Here is this strategic risk and trade-off from the military advice you're getting coming from the joint staff. And if there's not a seat at the table for that, if nobody's really interested in listening to it, it's hard to imagine how you keep people wanting to say that, because it's not actually that fun to be constantly the process is my Valentine, here is how we should actually
do it. So it's so fun. Everyone loves being the process is my Valentine.
I think what we've learned is Secretary of Defense Mattis does not like process Valentines, and like he right. should.
He super should.
Yeah.
And or at the very least, even if you are not going to listen to them all the time, it should always be clear that there's room for that sort of assessment to come in before a final decision is made. And if there's not, if you're never listening to that, like, why bother? Right. And I think you see a lot of that in the way in which, air quotes, civilian oversight is playing out.
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, we could also be asking this question about, like, where is the State Department?
Oh, yeah.
Which is to say, nowhere.
Right.
I mean, we're having like a full-throated discussion about how foreign policy is being architected by the Department of Defense in the absence of the State Department and without an interagency process at the White House. So there's lots of things going on here.
By the joint staff in the Department of Defense.
That's right. The joint staff in conjunction.
Just to be clear.
With their friends at the COCOMs, right? So.
Right.
There's a lot of dudes with stars making foreign policy here, and maybe not a lot of civilian input or oversight. But this is part of a much more long-term trend of consolidation of foreign policy influence at the Pentagon and on the uniform side of the Pentagon than just the last couple of years. So
feels like we're going to need a longer "this is still a thing" civilian military.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Well, Radha, come what may, I'm sure it will all be fine. Oh my God, use that as your hook. Jesus, woman.
You haven't watched. Radha, do you have some pop culture news that you would like to share with us?
We're on to pop culture. Sorry. Guys, Moulin Rouge is great.
Yes. And Come What May is an amazing song in that movie.
It is. It is. Sorry. I was still thinking about civilian military relations. I'd mentally transitioned to anything.
I could listen to you and McGregor sing just every day, all day long.
Yeah.
Did we talk about how I saw the stage version of this? I can't remember.
No.
No. That's right. You did see the stage version of
this. It's super good. I can't wait for it to come to Broadway.
How are the costumes
amazing? 15 times. I mean, the costumes are exactly what you think the costumes are. And
awesome.
They're pretty great. There's lots of pop culture things going on, actually.
Go ahead.
So we all watched The Night Manager when that was on a couple of years ago. And mm-hmm. So now having on that success, the AMC is now doing Little Drummer Girl, which is, I don't know, pretty close to being the worst Le Carré novel. But apparently they thought was going to meet great source material. It doesn't have Tom Hiddleston, so I'm a little concerned that I'm not going to like it as much. But, you know, it'll be 6-part and well shot with pretty costumes and settings. So I'm sure we'll watch that a little bit. Much more compellingly is that the Elena Ferrante series in Naples, the first book, My Brilliant Friend, has become like a 4 or 6-part series on HBO. And that starts this week. And it is entirely in Italian and dialect.
And apparently quite true to the novels, which will be exciting because they're long and robust with really beautiful writing. So
I'm fascinated to see how this works. They are difficult. They're not enjoyable novels.
No.
Exactly.
You don't like anyone.
But they're super compelling, and I'm interested to see kind of what that looks like on screen. So, you know, kind of adding that to my winter movie view. They're also like, none of those are like things that are super like freaky or dark or too weird, and so you can watch them in the winter.
Yeah, right.
which I think is good.
We are nearing the point of December when I start watching a Christmas movie or Christmas TV episode every day.
Good heavens, child.
It's amazing. If you get on Netflix or Amazon and you just like, you know, I want to watch the Garfield Christmas special or the Charlie Brown Christmas special.
I want to watch Die Hard, but like that one's hard to find.
Yeah. And you just do that every single day for the rest of the month, you end up feeling quite jolly by the end of the month.
I disagree with that. But
I'm with
Lauren on that.
You do? Yeah,
pour
of course
some
you
eggnog.
Do. Really, Radha? We're so surprised.
But like, let's
with
be realistic
tiara.
Here. I could watch
a
Love
Christmas
Actually
tiara.
Every day. Every day.
We should maybe do a drunk viewing of Love Actually and then live tweet it and let people chime in for that.
Yeah. I'm also rereading Cryptonomicon with the unique position of trying to picture Benedict Cumberbatch as every character in the book.
It's not going to work, but it actually
works pretty well.
He's not Bobby Shafto.
But if you picture him as Bobby Shafto, it's a, it's a unique re-perspectivizing of the novel.
Very well.
We've had a lot of
Barrel-Aged Manhattans.
Barrel-Aged Manhattans.
Yeah.
Any additional pop culture, Radha?
No, but I believe you guys have an event coming up.
Oh, we do. Thank you for reminding us. Lauren and I are going to be in my great hometown of Kansas City on December 4th at the World War I Museum talking about the Forever Wars. And if anybody is within a 200-mile radius, you should come and join us. You can meet, well, half my cousins and a bunch of my college friends. And it's going to be a grand old time had by everyone.
Can't wait.
Going to be great. All right, ladies. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
Bye.